Before we have the talk, let's generate our motivation. And so let's place what we're about to do within the context of making a positive contribution to society. And doing that by first increasing our own wisdom and compassion, and then reaching out to benefit others. If we lack strong compassion, if our wisdom is foggy, if we're not real skillful, then we may want to help, but whatever we do for others won't be very effective. So we want to really work on ourselves and develop our own good qualities and remove any hindrances to developing them. So that we can really make a positive contribution to the lives of other living beings. So, I thought to give you some kind of very general overview today, and then we'll get into more topics as time goes on. And I really welcome you telling me specific things that you want to hear about, and please feel free to ask whatever questions you have. We say that questioning is a sign of wisdom because it shows you you're thinking about things, you know, and you want to learn more. So feel totally free to ask whatever you like. So you'll hear us talking about the mind a lot. So unfortunately, the English word mind doesn't match the Sanskrit word citta. The word citta, sometimes it's translated as mind and sometimes as heart. Because in Buddhism, there's no difference made between the two. Not brain, okay? Brain and mind are different. And when we say heart, we don't mean the physical heart. We mean as we say, sometimes somebody has a very kind heart, yeah? So that kind of heart, yeah? And so in Buddhism, the mind and the heart are not separate things. In Western culture, we usually think the mind is up here with the brain, and the heart, you know, that feels emotions and so forth, is here. And there's some kind of brick wall in between because we can't get our mind and our heart in touch with each other and in sync. Okay. Take away that Western paradigm. That's not the way Buddhism looks at things. Okay. The mind and the heart are the same thing. You know, it's just different ways of translating the Sanskrit word citta. Okay. So when I say mind, don't think brain. Yeah, don't think brain, because they're very, very different. If you Google brain, you will find pages and pages and pages of material about the brain. If you Google mind, not much, okay? Because we usually go towards scientific explanations of things, and science talks a lot about the brain, because you can see it and touch it and measure it with scientific instruments. But scientists are really stuck when it comes to the mind. Yeah, they don't really know what it is, and they have a hard time talking about it. Okay? So in Buddhism, Yeah. The brain is, and I think science would agree here, the brain is something physical. You know, you can take the skull off and put the brain there, okay? And you can look at it, and I guess you can smell it, and, you know, feel it, and, you know, you can contact it with your senses. The mind, on the other hand, the definition of mind is that which is clear and clear and cognizant. Cognizant meaning knowing or aware. Okay, so clear, one meaning of clear means that it's without form. It's not material in nature. The brain is material in nature. The mind isn't. Okay? And the clear part also can mean that the mind is clear, like a mirror is clear, in the sense of being able to reflect things. You know, the mind reflects objects. And then cognizant, or knowing, means that the mind can engage with objects. So we can reflect, we can engage with objects. When you look at the green of the tablecloth, you know, the mind is reflecting that and perceiving it, knowing it. In Western culture, sometimes we are so, and human beings in general, you know, are so focused on the external sense objects that we don't pay attention to things that are not atomic in nature. And there's a lot of things that are not material or atomic in nature. Okay. Sometimes we try and make them atomic. Okay. If we talk about love, I think everybody has some knowledge of what love is, what love means. Yeah. Is love something you can measure by scientific instruments? Yeah. Now, scientists may say, oh, when you feel love, this area of your brain is more active. But is that area of the brain the experience of love? When they, you know, the scientists may say, oh, when you have love, you have more of this chemical oxytocin, yeah? And so that chemical oxytocin, you know, is that love? When that chemical is flowing in your brain, or when serotonin or dopamine is going, is that the experience of love? No, that's just some material chemical, okay? So what we experience as living beings is quite different than things that we can touch and feel that are made of atoms and molecules. When we talk about democracy, is democracy something you can see with your eyes or hear with your ears? Okay, it's not, is it? So there's lots and lots of things in this universe that exist that are not atomic in nature. And trying to reduce everything to material things, I think, can be quite harmful for us. On one hand, it brings new knowledge. And yes, it's very interesting that there's some synchronicity between, you know, chemical and electrical things in the brain and what somebody's experiencing. You know, it's interesting. Those, coordinating things are there. But it doesn't mean that the material stuff is the human experience. Okay? When you say to somebody, I love you, yeah, you don't imagine their brain on the table and looking at the brain and say, I love you. Do you? Yeah. But some people, I was at one conference one time with His Holiness Dalai Lama and some scientists. And there was one, you know, a couple of the scientists who were really, material reductionists, only material stuff. So we were kind of thinking afterwards, boy, when this guy goes home, you know, to his wife and says, I love you, you know, then she, you know, if she's a material reductionist, then she says, wait a minute, I have to measure the dopamine and the oxytocin in your brain. I have to, you know, check your galvanic skin response and your heart rate. And if those, you know, measure up, then I know that what you're saying is sincere. I mean, come on. It's ridiculous, isn't it? Yeah. So, so on one hand, we have the brain. On the other hand, we have sense objects, you know, things that are material in nature. Yeah. And in our realm of existence, there's a relationship between the two. We're embodied beings, okay? So at birth, we take a body. Or actually, before birth, we take a body. So what we call the person, you know, then there's the thing, what in the world is the person? What's the self? We say the word I all the time. I'm going here, I'm doing that, I'm thinking this, I'm feeling that. What is this I that's doing all these things? Yeah, have you ever wondered that? Who are you? What is this I? Yeah. Because that I, and when I'm talking about the capital I, not this I, okay, the capital I, that I is pretty important. We think about it day and night. We filter everything through how it's affecting that self, that person, who just happens to be me. Okay. Everything in our world completely revolves around I. But what in the world is that? What in the world is the I that's feeling and doing all these things? So throughout human history, people have many ideas of what the I is. Okay, some people say, well, the I is the body. Yeah, your body is who you are. Is your body who you are? Is your body who you are? Yeah. The body is basically some vegetable glue. Isn't it? I mean, we preen our body a lot and we try and dress up the vegetable goo. But at the end of the day, it's organic goo, isn't it? Yeah? I mean, you have the sperm and the egg and all the food you've eaten. That's what the body is. Is that who you are? Okay, so that brings some problems. We can't really say we're the body. Then, well, actually, who was it? You probably remember better than I do. You know that somebody in previous centuries said there was a little homunculus behind our pituitary gland. I don't know which person who was it said, but like some little guy sitting there behind our pituitary gland. That's the I, that's the person. Kind of like in The Wizard of Oz, you know, you have all this big show and I am the wizard and the flashing lights. And then Toto goes behind the screen and pulls it off. There's this little old man, you know. So, oh yeah, there's some little old guy in there who's calling the shots. Really? Do you think that's who you are? Yeah. So that doesn't work too well. So then, what theistic religions do now is because they see, okay, the body is changing all the time, the emotions and thoughts are changing all the time. They say there must be something permanent permanent, that doesn't change, that is the person. And that's the self with a capital S, or in Western theology, Western religions, it's the
soul.
Yes, the soul. Thank you. Yeah, so we dream up an idea of a self with a capital S or a soul. Okay? And the soul is something permanent. You know, most religions say it's permanent. It doesn't change. And it's the essence of who you are. So your body changes throughout your life. Your thoughts and emotions change. But there's this thing that really is you that doesn't change. And, you know, most people in the West grew up with this idea of a soul. Okay. Problem with that is, well, there's many problems with it, actually. One of the problems is, where did that soul come from? You know? And another problem is if the soul is permanent, then how does the person change? Because permanent means it doesn't change from moment to moment. Okay? Do you change from moment to moment? Are you the same person who came here yesterday? When you really look, we say, oh yeah, I'm the same person because, you know, you have the same name and your body is similar. Is your body exactly the same as it was yesterday? Yeah. Are your thoughts and your feelings the same as they were yesterday? Are you frozen in time, unchanging? Okay. So if we say that the person is something permanent, we run into that kind of problem. Okay? And then we also run into the problem of where, if the soul is permanent, that means it doesn't have a cause and it doesn't have an effect. But then where did the soul come from if it didn't have a cause? So then we say, well, then there was a permanent creator, an independent creator. But creation involves change. Yeah? If there's a creator, for the creator to create something, the creator changes. And what the creator, the substance, or not necessarily physical substance, but to create, it involves changing one thing or another. So what is that? Yeah. If you posit some independent creator, yeah, it gets really kind of confusing. Because what is that creator? If it's permanent, how did it change to create? Why did the creator create? Yeah? How many of you went to Sunday school when you were little? Yeah? Most of us. Did you ever ask that question? Yeah? Why did God create us? What kind of answer did you get? Yeah? When you ask that question, what answer do you get? I was told, God created us because God was lonely. Yeah. But if God is perfect, how can he be lonely? Okay. And then I was told God created us so that we can learn and become closer to him. Well, why didn't he create us? Why separate only so that you can come together again? Yeah. Yeah? That didn't make much sense to me. Then I asked, why is there suffering? That's a big question, isn't it? Why is there suffering in this world? That's the thing we really want to work on. Why is there suffering? And I was told, so that we can learn from suffering. God wanted us to learn from suffering. And I thought, why didn't God make us smarter to start with? What's there to learn from suffering? If you can control it in the beginning, you know, make us smarter. So otherwise, what's the purpose of suffering? So, you know, if you assert some kind of independent creator like that, you get some kind of logical hang-ups in there. And finally, you know, because I was an inquisitive kid, I kept asking the same question and checking out different answers. Then the ultimate answer was, be quiet and believe. Yeah, just have faith. And I thought, just have faith? I can't have faith in something I don't understand. That doesn't make sense to me. Because there's so many things in this world, that there's so many different religions and different spiritualities. And if I'm just supposed to have faith without understanding, then what differentiates one religion from another? Yeah? Which one do I choose if I'm just supposed to have faith? Okay? So, personally speaking, you know, I couldn't go down that road. I needed something that I understood, that made sense to me. Okay? So I'm not putting down people who believe in an external creator. That belief system works for them. It helps them become better people. But it's not for me. Okay? So we can disagree with people based on philosophy or, you know, psychology or theology or whatever, but that doesn't mean we have to criticize those people. Okay? If something helps them, great. Yeah? But that doesn't mean it helps me. Some people like rice, some people like noodles. You can't, you know. I prefer noodles. My system doesn't go well with rice, but I don't go around saying everybody should eat noodles and nobody should eat rice, just because that's what works with me. Okay? So Buddhism is very accepting of other faiths, yeah, in that sense. We may debate philosophy, yeah, and we consider debating something really good and useful because it makes you think and you have to have some understanding. But it's done in the spirit of learning, not in the spirit of dominating other people and proving them wrong, just so that you can win the argument like we were talking about last night. Okay. And so similarly, Buddhism doesn't go around saying everybody should become a Buddhist, you know, and if you don't, well, you know what's going to happen to you. So there's nothing like that in Buddhism. Okay? It's, yeah. We realize that people are different, and different people will be attracted to different philosophies, different faiths. And as long as that faith teaches them ethical conduct and, you know, to abandon harming others, to be kind to others, then that's going to help them be a better person, and that's good. Yeah. And we leave the rest. Yeah. Okay. So let's come back to the body and mind. Okay. What we call person is when the body and mind are related to each other. Okay, there's a relationship between the body and mind. So we say that this happens at the time of conception. I don't want to get into the whole abortion debate. I know it's quite popular, but we can talk about that a little bit later. But just to give you a preview, I am pro-choice and anti-abortion. Okay, so I'm both. So what we call the person is the body and mind are related. They're linked. Okay? And we can see that there's a relationship between our body and mind. Yeah? When our body is sick, it affects, you know, our moods. We can also see that when we're in certain moods, it affects our body. Yeah? So it goes both ways. There's some kind of influence both ways. Yeah? We see people who have very good attitudes, they usually recover quicker from surgery and illness and so forth. Yeah? So there's a relationship. Relationship doesn't necessarily mean causality. Okay? Just means there's a relationship. Doesn't mean one necessarily causes the other. So life is when the body and mind are joined. Death is they separate. Okay? The body has its continuum because the body is physical in nature. It's made of atoms and molecules. So its continuum is material in nature. So body becomes a corpse. Yeah, the worms have a really good lunch, or it gets burnt, and you know the chemicals go in the chemicals. I mean, that's how we are. Organic chemicals go into the atmosphere, and the remainder becomes ashes. So that's the continuity of the body. You know, the thing that's physical. The continuity of the mind or the consciousness is not material. Okay? But the consciousness doesn't cease at the time of death. It continues on. It has a continuum. Just as one moment of the body produces the next moment, just as one moment of something that's material produces the next moment, so one moment of that which is clear and cognizant produces the next moment. Yeah. You can see from your own experience, your consciousness is a continuum, isn't it? Yeah. It doesn't cease from one day to the next. It keeps going, and one moment of your consciousness causes the next moment, and so on. Okay? So then the question comes, okay, we know what happens to the body at the time of death. What happens to the consciousness, to the mind? Yeah, because we don't talk about a soul in Buddhism. We don't assert any kind of permanent soul like that. So we're left with the consciousness. What happens to the consciousness when it separates from the body? Okay, I remember seeing one Hollywood movie where some guy dies and then this kind of amorphous thing like comes out of his body and goes over here and went into the body of a dog. It's not like that. Okay, that's Hollywood. But again, one moment of consciousness produces the next moment. And in beings like us who don't know the nature of reality, who have obscured minds, then we're attracted towards another kind of body. Yeah. So we go through a stage when the mind leaves this body. There's an intermediate stage. The Tibetan term for that is bardo. And then when, you know, it's time to be reborn, then that consciousness enters the new body. Okay? And then a new life begins. In terms of what body the consciousness enters, that depends on our karma. Okay? So, karma means action. It's not something mysterious, you know. People throw around the word karma all the time now without really knowing what it means. So karma simply means action. So it could be physical actions, what we do with our body. It can be verbal actions, how we speak to people. It can be mental actions, what we think, what we plan, what we feel. Okay? So according to, you know, because Buddhism is very strong in causality, you know, that you have to have, for everything that exists, you know, that is changing moment by moment, it has to have a cause. Things don't come out of nowhere. So you have the cause with one moment, you know, producing, one moment of consciousness producing the next moment. And that just continues after the mind leaves this body and goes into another body. And it's attracted to whatever body that it enters in the next life, dependent upon the actions that we did in this life and the actions we did in previous lives. Okay, so yesterday when Venerable Tarpa gave her BBC, I was thinking, oh my goodness, you people are probably really confused. She's talking about all these things that you've never heard about before, except death, you know. But we've all heard about that. But, you know, she was talking about lower realms and she was, you know, all this kind of stuff. You know, we have to kind of start at the beginning, I think. You know, the point of her talk, you know, and the point why Buddhists talk about death is so that we can make our life meaningful, because what we do in this life influences other living beings now and creates happiness or suffering in the world. And also because what we do in this life, our actions, create the causes for what we will be in our future lives. And since we want to be happy in our future lives, then we want to create the causes of happiness and abandon the causes of suffering. Okay? So in this thing of being reborn and taking different bodies, there's nobody who assigns us a body. Again, there's no creator. There's no manager of the universe. There's no supreme authority who runs the show. Yeah. What makes things happen are simply causes and conditions. So that part of Buddhism, talking about how things arise depending on causes and conditions, is very much in sync with science. Because that's what science is about. What causes and conditions produce what results. It's just that science has limited itself to material and physical causes and results, whereas Buddhism looks at the causes and results on immaterial levels too. Okay, but it's the same idea that, you know, things that exist and function, they don't appear out of nowhere. Things don't happen without any causes. And the causes cannot be some supreme authority because of the things that I was saying before. Yeah? Like, what would make the supreme authority do certain things? Yeah? And if there's lower rebirths and higher rebirths, why would a creator send their own creation to a lower rebirth to suffer? I asked that question as a kid. I mean, these people couldn't answer it for me. Yeah? It doesn't make any sense. If you love your creation, why would you send them to a place where they suffer? Do people learn from intense suffering? Yeah? Usually they... People, you know, if you've had really intense suffering, if you're smart, maybe you learn from it. But most people, when they have intense suffering, they get angry or they get discouraged. They don't learn much. They just wallow in self-pity. Or they're so involved with their pain that they can't think about anything else. Yeah. So why would any kind of supreme being make that happen? Okay? So in Buddhism we say it's our own actions that produce what we become. It's not some external something acting on us. Yeah. It's coming from our own actions. And our actions are all rooted in our own mind. Okay? Because in general, our body doesn't move unless the mind has an intention to move. I'm not talking about hitting your knee and your leg kicks forward, you know, that's involuntary. But, you know, I'm moving my hand, there's some intention in my consciousness to move my hand. We don't speak unless, again, there's movement in the mind, there's action in the mind. All of our thoughts and so on, yeah, these are things that are caused by the mind. Okay, what are we thinking? What are we feeling? What is our motivation for doing what we do? And so, you know, that's why in Buddhism we say that our mind is basically the source of everything. That if you trace everything back, it's going to come to consciousness in the end. Yeah? In the sense that consciousness influences things. And we can really begin to see that in our lives as we, you know, as you develop a meditation practice, as you become more aware of what you're doing in your life, you can really see how your mind makes things happen. I'm not saying that just because we think something we can make it happen. I'm not saying that, okay? But that we can see the relationship. Okay, so I think I've talked enough. Some of you are dozing off. Maybe we can have some questions and comments now, and a little bit of discussion, what you thought about all of this. Yeah?
So what you were just talking about, how everything we do with our bodies is voluntary, including thoughts and everything like that, how does something like mental illnesses that cause like intrusive thoughts and stuff like that, how
yeah.
is that related to all that?
Okay. So I'm not saying that we have control over everything we think. Yeah. We just did the meditation at the beginning of the session. Anybody here not have a distraction? Yeah. We all got distracted, didn't we? So we don't have full control over our mind. Because we're usually so glued on the external world and trying to rearrange it that we forget about the internal world. Yeah. So something like mental illness, okay, it would come from the mind in the sense that, well, there's different kinds of mental illness, okay? So some mental illness depends on the thoughts. Some mental illness may be have a relationship with brain chemistry. But why did that person take that particular body with that particular brain chemistry? That would be because of their own actions. Okay? It doesn't mean that any of that is permanent. It's all changing all the time. Yeah? Yeah.
Reading a book right now about it's kind of a memoir of this neuroscientist who had cancer, which caused her to have like dementia like reactions, which she then recovered from, so she kind of remembers what it was like to have dementia. Mm. But she's also a neuroscientist who studies schizophrenia and works in a brain lab where they basically take brains from people who have donated their organs and like study them to see if they can figure out where schizophrenia comes from, which I was reading it and I was like, I mean, I don't know if you're going to get very far just looking at the organ of the brain, but I was wondering if that, if you have any comments about that kind of thing at all.
What, the fact?
The studying the brains themselves.
Yeah. Like I said, it's interesting, and if they can juggle things in the brain that can reduce suffering, great. But I don't think that's going to get at the real cause of what's going on. Yeah? Because if you keep tracing back, you know, you might juggle the brain, but then, you know, where did human life come from? Why is there consciousness, you know, in that body to start with? Okay, so there's lots of questions that lie behind that. Yeah, but it's been interesting because there's been a number of people who, scientists, who have had things happen with their brain and then watched how, what was going on, what their own experience was, and how it doesn't match up with their scientific study. Okay? There was one man who, I actually heard him speak. I can't remember his name. But, you know, he had some kind of near-death experience, and he knew neurologically what was going on in his brain, and that he shouldn't have had any consciousness, according to neurology. But he was seeing all these different things, and, you know, he was experiencing a totally different environment. And he couldn't explain it according to his own neurological study. Yeah? So, what's the name of the person who was?
Her name is Barbara Lipska.
Okay, yeah. This is, I think I've heard of her, and then there's another woman too who was a neurologist who had some kind of experience like that. Quite interesting though. Yeah. You had something?
Yeah. You say that nothing comes out of nowhere, that everything's from a cause, and whenever you think about like where does consciousness come from, and you start tracing back and you think of evolution and how we weren't even always Homo sapiens. There were other types of humanoid creatures way back in the past, and we developed this slowly, and that's the same way that we developed consciousness. Like, we weren't always able to perceive the world as we are now, and so it was a slowly developed thing throughout time. And I mean, you can even see it now in, like, chimpanzees and stuff, how they are slowly learning how to use tools and stuff, and I mean, probably eventually they'll be turned into something else that has a consciousness that is able to, you know, think and stuff like that. So,
which is turning into consciousness, did you say?
Chimpanzees. I mean,
chimps, yeah. Yeah. So you can see some kind of evolutionary development. Yeah. And you can see, I mean, that's a good illustration of causes and conditions and how things change and develop. Yeah. So I have no qualms with that. Yeah. I think it's quite interesting, though, to remember that planet Earth isn't necessarily the only place where there's life. Yeah, we tend to think that we're the only place that's life. But here you can see the stars, unlike in the city. So let's hope it clears up. At night, it's amazing. Stand out and you look, and there's the whole Milky Way. And you look at all these stars and you think, you know, they have planets and solar systems, and there's a lot of space out there and a lot of room for sentient life, sentient meaning having consciousness. So there could be all sorts of living beings out there, yeah, that we can't see with our eyes or hear or anything. But, you know, many different life forms. Yeah?
So we're talking today about reincarnation, but
but yesterday you talked about how humans are different from animals because in general, like, it's the idea that animals can't distinguish between virtuous and non-virtuous action.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So if that's true, and like your kind of like your merit term determines your next life, if animals can't distinguish between virtuous and non-virtuous action, how do they generate merit?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So before those beings took rebirth in an animal body, they might have been humans. Okay? And as humans, created some merit, but at the time of death of their human life, some kind of negative karma ripened, which threw them into an animal rebirth. But then when that karma is over and they die from the animal rebirth, then the positive karma they had created as a human being, if they created some, could ripen and throw them into a human rebirth again.
What do you mean by ripening?
Pardon?
What do you mean by ripening?
Ripening, we talk about when, so karma is an action. It leaves, we call it a seed, but it's not a physical seed. It's like an energy trace. When caught on the consciousness and the continuity of the consciousness, when causes and conditions come together, then that energy trace, that seed of karma, ripens, meaning that it brings its result. So it may ripen in terms of attracting the consciousness to a particular body, and so its next rebirth. It can ripen in terms of what we experience in that rebirth. It can ripen in terms of our general habits. It can ripen in terms of what kind of environment we live in, you know, what kind of environment, yeah, that we find ourselves living in. So that karma can ripen in a variety of different results. Yeah, so ripen just means that it goes from being that seed, that imprint on the consciousness, to bringing, you know, an experience of some sort.
So I know you said that rebirth was not something that you could test with science, or like you can't see it and you can't measure it. So how do you know that there's a continuity between the different lives, and that it's not just one fading into an ether or something? And then, like, where are you getting this information?
Mm-hmm.
And then the second part is, do you think that Buddhism could function without the concept of rebirth, or is rebirth totally essential to it?
Okay. So, in terms of where we get this information, okay, there's several people who have done studies on this. And one of them is, he's from University of Virginia. What was his name? Do you remember his name? He wrote a whole big book about it. And he studied many cases of this, of following situations where children remembered their previous rebirth and really going and checking them out. And there's some things online too, those I have the URLs to watch, where, you know, there's children who have definite memories. There was one Indian, young Indian girl in India, and she remembered very clearly what her previous life was in another village, and she could describe the family and the family members and everything. And at one point, her present life family took her over there, and she remembered all the people. She could talk about what happened, you know, because she was a relative in that family. She could talk about what happened in their lives. And the family verified, yes, those things did happen. Okay? So you have that kind of thing where people do have memories. In the case of you know, with the Dalai Lama, they have this thing of, and with other Tibetans, of looking for the future life of very, you know, people who are believed to have high realizations. In the case of the Dalai Lama, it was very interesting how they found him. They did some religious meditations and services, and they got some direction that he would take rebirth in the northeast part of Tibet. That's the Amdo area. So the previous Dalai Lama died in the early 30s. The present one was born in 35. They sent out a search party to look for him. And when they send out the search party, they don't say, "We're looking for the Dalai Lama," because everybody would come and say, "Oh, it's my kid," you know. But rather, they dress up as merchants. And this is in old Tibet. So merchants in old Tibet, you had your yaks and your goods on your yaks. They didn't have hotels and motels. So you just stopped at a farmer's place and they put you up for the night. So this search party was, you know, disguised as a bunch of merchants. They went to this one home in Amdo, and what was interesting is the monks who were looking for the child were disguised as the people who took care of the animals, because the animal caretakers, whenever you stayed in a home, would always eat in the kitchen, whereas the merchants, who were seen as more high class, would eat in the shrine room. So these monks, they wanted to go in the kitchen because that's where the kids were. Okay, so they were disguised like that. They went in the kitchen. There's this little boy. This little boy jumps on the lap of one of these monks who's dressed like an animal caretaker and says, "I know you. You are Lama so-and-so." He knew his name. And somebody else said, "Oh no, I'm sorry. It was the first thing. They were wearing the prayer beads of the previous Dalai Lama, and the kid jumped up onto this person's lap, pulled at the prayer beads, and said, 'These are mine.'" And so somebody else in the search party said, "We'll give them to you if you can tell us who this is." And he said, "Oh, you're Lama so-and-so, I know you." Okay? And then, you know, he recognized other things from his previous life as well. And he knew the Lhasa dialect, which in Amdo they didn't speak. Yeah, so there are all these kinds of things that, you know, he had some memory of the previous life. In a more Western way, I gave a talk one time in Florida at a public library. So there were a bunch of senior citizens there. And they wanted to hear about rebirth, so I talked about rebirth. And one woman came up to me afterwards and she said, "Wow, that really helps me understand my son. Because my son, from the time he was little, he was so musically inclined. Nobody else in the family knew any was musically inclined. Nobody knew different things. But my son, he would hear a certain piece of classical music and he would say, 'This is Beethoven's number blah blah, and this is, you know, what is it, you know, some other composer's number blah blah.'" Okay. And she said, "Oh, now I know, you know, he must have had some exposure to music in a previous life, you know, that planted those kinds of seeds in his mind, so that as a kid, he could identify these things and was attracted to music." Huh? So, you know, it can be interesting. Did you ever wonder why you were born in the family you were born in? Yeah. why was I born in this family? Do you think like everybody in your family? Yeah? No. So, is who we are just a product of genes? Is it just a product of our environment? Yeah. If you talk to your parents and ask them when they had you, and if you have siblings, if you came out as blank slates, or if you had a personality from the time you came out of your mother's womb, yeah, ask them. And they will tell you that every kid has a personality when they come out. You know, we don't come out blank slates. We have tendencies. Yeah, we have interests. Yeah. So this indicates, you know, a causal relationship with things we were familiar with in previous lives.
Once I asked a similar question about how does Buddhism knows all the things that they explain about the mind, about all the realms, about rebirth and karma and everything. So they explained me that there are some kinds, this mental training can be so profound, and there are some kind of absorptions, I don't know, but that it tends to be very, very profound, so that they can perceive everything in other way,
yeah.
But not like an illusion, but real.
But directly, yes.
So that's how they tend to discover all these things.
Yeah.
Since years and years and a lot of masters and teachers who does it again and again.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Because the mind can be developed to that point where we can have direct perception of all these things. Right now, we can't, so we rely on stories, we rely on reasoning, and so on. But the mind can definitely be developed to see all of that.
I just have another question. Like, you said that we, like the eye, is this mixture of body and mind.
Mm-hmm.
And then there is the consciousness.
Consciousness and mind I'm using as synonymous.
So, who controls the mind?
This is a very good question.
Because I start thinking, they give me definition of what the mind is,
mm-hmm.
like in this Buddhist way. So they say that it was like a mixture of these physical psycho aggregates
mm-hmm.
that are the cause of karma and conditions.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't understand how that can control the mind.
Okay. So we usually think that there's an independent I that controls things. Okay. That there's the person, you know, I'm directing my thoughts. But there isn't some kind of independent, separate thing that's the I, yeah? But what we call I, or self, or person, is there's a combination of body and mind, and independence on that, we give it the name person, yeah? So there's just a person that exists by being designated independence on the body and mind. There's no I inside like a soul that's directing the show, okay? It's a hard idea for us to understand because we so much feel like there's a me. Don't you feel like there's a me? You know, there's I. I'm sitting here. Yeah. But when you really ask, you can't pinpoint something separate from the body and mind that is you. All you can do is see there's a bunch of different factors together that function in a certain way, and we call that me. We'll get into that a little bit later. One more question, and then we'll take a break.
I was just going to ask a similar question, like, who is the doer? And kind of like on the thoughts, this kind of almost being like commentary to the I kind of aspect of our, I guess, being. Like our thoughts are kind of like just like this commentary, like kind of like advertisements we see. I don't know your thoughts on that.
So our thoughts, okay, say that again. So you're saying there's some kind of nature of being, and then our thoughts are commentary on that? Or I want to make sure I understand what you're saying before I respond.
So it seems like there's some points in Buddhism where there's no thoughts, where there's just kind of just compassion, just seeing through compassion. But then there seems to be these thoughts that do arise, but they seem to be almost like distractions in some ways.
Oh, okay.
Kind of like walls or barriers or...
Okay, there's different kinds of thoughts, yeah? So there's the distracting thoughts that pop up and say, why did this person say this to me, and I can't stand that, and why is the world like this, and I want it to be like that, and shut up. Okay, so there's those kind of thoughts. Those ones are big hassles, so we want to get rid of them, okay? Then there's more subtle kind of conceptual minds, yeah? Where there may, there's some kind of thought, but it's not so obvious. For example, compassion is a certain kind of attitude or conceptual mind, but it's not sitting there jabbering all the time, like the distracting ones. Okay. And then there's what we call direct perception, which is seeing directly without any concept intervening. Okay. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it seems like they're kind of like a progression of like refinement.
Yes.
In the thoughts.
Yeah. And in one day, we have probably all of them. In terms of direct perception, you know, our eyes and ears and nose and tongue and body, you know, are directly perceiving the physical world. That doesn't mean that that is fantastic. It's just, you know, the way we do. What we want to work with is mental direct perception, which relates to her question of developing the mind such that things that we cannot perceive directly now become perceivable. Okay? One way to get to some of that is through using thought, but refining thought again and again and again and again, and then eventually breaking through the conceptual appearance and having direct perception. Okay? Okay, we gotta stop. We're going to stop. Okay? So let's just sit for a minute. And bring to mind some of the things we talked about that you want to continue to think about so that you'll remember them. And let's rejoice at the virtue or the merit, the positive energy that we created as individuals and as a group. Just feel happy about it. And then send that out into the universe. together with your wishes, your aspirations, that through the merit, the virtue, the positive energy we created here, it may bring the ultimate peace and joy to all sentient beings, that it may act as one cause among many for that to happen.